Okay, let's begin. I have to start with a very interesting thing, which is there's a serious typo in this in these lessons, because the third point, the third quality that you need is not determination, but discrimination. And I'm so interested in the fact that I managed to make determination into something, because it's like a challenge to. But it never made any sense that the word discrimination wasn't on here, and I couldn't figure out why in the world the word determination was. So I finally looked a little later, and I mean, I know he made reference even later when I was reading it to discrimination, how there'd be a whole section on it, but it wasn't until I really looked at it this evening that I saw. So, discrimination is the third quality. Devotion, will, and discrimination, which makes a lot more sense. I definitely did, because what could I say? There it was in front of me. Swami used to say that he could make a sermon out of anything. Somebody gave him, you know, some ridiculous challenge, and he did it. I don't remember what it was, but he managed to, because everything. So obviously determination is an important quality, but discrimination is much more important. So I'll say a little bit about it, and then I'll go on. I mean, discrimination is a really simple fact of being able to discern what is actually happening. And it's absolutely fundamental to the spiritual path. You know, we think discrimination is not being prejudiced, it's being actually able to tell what is actually going on in the world and what is simply a projection of my own egoic disturbance. And you can see that without discrimination, you really can't get anywhere on the path. And so I just couldn't believe he left it off. He didn't. Okay. Now, does anybody have any thoughts or comments or questions from last week? Discrimination? Okay, let me pause for just a second. Isn't that odd? Just, you know, sort of. Well, somebody is telling you that you're being unkind to them, and you're saying, I wasn't being unkind, I was just speaking frankly, there's nothing wrong with speaking the truth. And to being able to discern whether or not you actually have been insensitive to their reality and have said something that's inappropriate, whether their criticism is valid, or whether you realize that you're just dealing with someone who's going to criticize you no matter what you do. And then you have to be able to discern what the reality of that situation really is through self-honesty, by careful attention. Then you have to use your discrimination to be able to understand what would be the appropriate response in this situation. Is this a situation in which I need to just graciously apologize regardless? And that may not depend so much on what the other person's reality is as what your own reality is. And all of those things, just step by step, you have to be able to tell what dharma is. What you're trying to discriminate is, what is dharma? What action will expand consciousness in this situation?
You mentioned what's going. You have to be able to tell what's going on in the world. Is it more often than not between people, or could it be what's going on in the world and where do I stand in all that?
Absolutely everything. You always have to be able to tell. You have to always be able to be impersonal and detached enough to be able to see what is really going on. I mean, how many times have you decided that someone was mad at you, or that someone had treated you unfairly, or that they really didn't like you and they were criticizing you for something? And then you have to stop and think whether they really are. I mean, countless times you finally write to someone, oh, I'm so sorry for what I did, and they say, what are you talking about? It never happened. I know Swami Kriyananda, people are always projecting upon him some discomfortableness of themselves. When I used to work for him, he would get letters, you know, periodically. I'm so sorry about the way I spoke to you. And Swami would just sort of look and say, please tell them I have no idea what they're talking about. You know, it just never happened. It was just their own nervousness. And they imagined that he was doing it. Because you can't, you know, if you're nervous, anxious, judging yourself, insecure, you'll just assume that the world is feeding that back. And discrimination is the ability to tell whether it really is or isn't. Then, of course, discrimination is, do I really want to follow this course of action? Is this desire really going to take me anywhere that I need to go? Is this a desire that I need to fulfill thoughtfully with Divine Mother's company, or is this something I can repudiate and it'll put me aside? Is this thought that I really need to go here and do this thing just the product of restlessness, or is it really the result of an inner intuition? To tell between emotion and intuition, to tell between true and false visions and meditation, true and false guidance, everything, everything is a matter of discrimination.
How is discrimination different from intuition?
You have to discriminate to tell whether you're coming from intuition or not. Intuition is the calm knowing, but sometimes you can't always tell whether your intuition is true or false, and so discrimination is the capacity to know whether your intuition is true or false. Intuition is direct knowledge. Discrimination is discerning among things. You know, if you have an intuitive reality. Once when we were first starting the pilgrimages to India, after the first pilgrimage, I had a very strong feeling we should do one the following year. That was true intuition, as it turned out. I did not exercise discrimination in how I worked with that intuition, and I tried to impose that intuition on people who didn't want to hear it. And I kept trying to impose that intuition on people who didn't want to hear it until all those people got really mad at me. And then I had the discrimination to say, gee, I think I'll withdraw from this discussion because, as I wrote to them, whether my intuition was true or not, my actions since then have clouded the waters. So I withdraw. And that was, it took discrimination for me to tell I should withdraw. And then after I withdraw and let the waters calm, they all came to the same decision I had suggested. So intuition was accurate, discrimination was lacking. Discrimination got into the picture, and then intuition held the day, as it turned out. Does that make sense?
Would you say that discrimination is a little bit more on the part of how I am acting and relating and behaving and
I can use my
being, you know, in my relation to everything outside of myself?
Well, you can also discriminate about how other people are behaving. Okay. You can discern everything. You can tell whether...
It's a big
discernment is just being able to discrimination. I use the word discernment too. Is just being able to tell, you know, what is the upward moving divine energy and what is not the upward moving divine energy. So that could be everywhere, absolutely in every situation. The capacity to develop divinely guided discrimination is one of the essentials on the spiritual path. Otherwise, somebody comes to you and says, oh, you know, there's a great satsang going on over here. Let's go see this other teacher. And you use your discrimination to say, well, he may be a fine teacher, but it's really not, I'm really not going to expose myself to a whole lot of other realities because it's not good for me. So you have to be able to use your discrimination to tell what's good and what isn't. Somebody says you should fast for 40 days, it'll purify you and enable you to see God. And you might say, I don't think so. Okay? Discrimination is everything. That's why I couldn't believe you left it off the list. Push the button on the top. Why don't we just leave this on all the time so we don't have to... Okay.
So would it be fair to say also that in order to be discriminating, you have to be able to step back and be impersonal.
Absolutely.
And the word that's more commonly used perhaps is objective.
Right.
But I was thinking impersonal in the sense of not involved emotionally in order to be discerning.
Right.
You have to be able to...
It's the likes and dislikes of the heart that cloud our discrimination. Because when we have likes and dislikes... we can't really perceive what's happening because we have a point of view. And so to be able to be impersonal, which in this sense would mean detached, and just not have prejudices. So that's why blessed are the pure in heart. The pure in heart do not have all the likes and dislikes. And when the heart is perfectly calm, then one can simply perceive what is. And that's why purity of heart, that's why the first quality is devotion. Because if you have that devotion, you develop this purity of consciousness, which is that you put your heart in the one place it belongs, which is in relationship to God. Purity in this sense simply means to take out of your heart that which doesn't belong. And what doesn't belong is all of this attraction. See, a lack of discrimination says, well, how could I possibly, you know, live without really having that apartment? I mean, God doesn't want me to live in a small place, does he? You know, these are the kinds of things that people will say. I think God wants me to have nice things, you know, and I think it's fine for me to buy a Cadillac after all, I earned all the money, and I could give that money to a good cause, but, I mean, I think it's just fine for me to spend it on myself. Don't you think so? I think that's what God wants me to do. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. You know, you have to be able to be detached enough to really see whether or not, in fact, it really is the right thing to do, because it's not always just such a dogmatic line, you know, that this is right and this is wrong. It depends a lot on very sensitive factors. Adam?
Since you brought it up, I'll ask about it, because I was reading The New Path today, and it sort of talked about, you know, likes and dislikes being, you know, of the ego and drawing right. you away from your center. I was just wondering, as I was reading that and as you're saying this, I mean, how do you detach from that? I mean, in terms of a practice, right. you know, from saying, you know, I like a soft comforter, I don't like one that's made of hay.
Right.
You know what I mean? It seems right. natural to have certain likes and dislikes, right. obviously.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, as a spiritual practice, how would I develop an impersonal nature to such things?
First, you have to use your discernment to decide which battles are really worth fighting. And, you know, in centuries ago, tremendous physical austerity and self-denial and was just part of the practice. This course, of course, is a total package, and we're just taking it step by step. But one of the things he talks about repeatedly is, you know, following the path as the guru teaches it. So, some paths would have you fight every little tiny thing, like the soft comforter versus the scratchy one. But Master chose a middle way. And he lived in comfortable circumstances. Swami Kriyananda exemplifies for us simple comfort. He doesn't tell us that we have to become nervous about everything. You know, for all the years that I've known Swami, he's eaten nice food, he goes out to nice restaurants, he occasionally goes to movies, you know, he'll take a vacation in a nice hotel. So just some of the sort of natural inclinations on this path, we don't bother to fight all those things. What we really fight is those inclinations of the heart that really cloud our judgment and really set us off in directions that separate us from the fundamentals of our spiritual life. Now, even then, it's very, very helpful to have someone with more experience than you helping you understand which way to go. It's very difficult to be able to read yourself accurately, especially when you're new, because you just get nervous about everything. And often you get nervous about the wrong things and then ignore the things that are the most important. Plus, you can't bend a twig too sharply or it breaks off. So it's more important to allow yourself enough latitude to be able to keep your fundamental relationship to the path than it is to discipline yourself so hard that you will just absolutely begin to hate your spiritual life and will then literally have to run away from it. So the best idea is to just become conscious, to begin to use your discrimination, to watch how often what one asserts as a need is really just a preference. And what one asserts as a principle or a value is really just an opinion. And in a comfortable way that doesn't make you what they call in Catholicism over-scrupulous, so you can't just be spontaneous anymore, just begin to watch. And sort of ask yourself, you know, why do I really feel this way? What's the basis of this? And rather than becoming your own enemy, you simply become an interested observer in your life. You know, you watch how pretty girls attract your attention. You watch how fancy cars make you fantasize. You watch how pictures in magazines make you wish that you were taller and broader. And, you know, how clothes in the window make you wish you had a different figure.
It's like you know me.
But I'm so sorry. We'll just call you Mr. X for purposes of the tape here. Yeah, but you see, that's what you begin to watch. Yeah. And at first, really, just watch it. Just sort of watch and just kind of begin to get familiar with how often I'm just being knocked around. Yeah. And then you begin to find the places where you can actually take a stand and win. And you just don't try to fight every battle. I was talking on the path for almost as long, 35 years, of they teachings. And it got, the guy was stretching beyond his capacity, and it just created all kinds of complexes. And when we talked about it, I said, you know, it never occurred to me that those teachings applied to me. It's just like they were so far beyond anything I could possibly do that I read the same books, I heard the same lectures, but I just let those things go right through because it was just not a chance, you know. And I was trying to say to this devotee that, you know, to a certain extent, what you tried to think of as your spiritual prowess was actually your pride. You know, I can do this, I can do this, when in fact it was so disconnected to what was really going on inside. That's why it's better to take very small steps. And you play with it. It's sort of fun. I mean, you do the things that you can enjoy doing. You know, it's like, if you can enjoy the fact that you used to like your coffee with cream, but now you drink it black and you think that's fun, go ahead and do that. Otherwise, just say, who cares? As Swami said, food is the last legitimate pleasure of the yogi. So you just let it go. But if you have a tendency to always want the front seat, even though somebody else is really uncomfortable in the back seat, then you can think, well, you know, you have a bad back, you sit in the front. I mean, those are the things where you can really, you know, discipline your preferences. I like the front seat. But if you throw up in the back seat, I think you should stay in the front seat. You know, it's like you have to use your good sense step by step. Does that begin to help?
A lot, yeah.
And it's a lifetime practice. And that's what's so interesting. I was talking to a young friend who is newer on the path because he's newer as an adult person. He hasn't had many years as an adult. But I was talking to him about just how fun it is. Because once you start making your life about your consciousness, it's always interesting. Because wherever you are, there's something really interesting that you can do. Whatever circumstance you're in, you can always work on your consciousness. So you're never bored, you're always challenged, and there's always something more interesting to go forward. If you're willing to put out the energy and just play the game. The last thing I would say about this is not a sprint. This is a long-distance run. So it won't do you any good to just, you know, run as hard as you can and then just fall over because you won't even really have reached the starting line, what to speak of the finish line. So it's much better to just be very sensible and move at an easy pace until you yourself train a little bit and then realize, oh, I can push this a little harder. Does that make sense? Okay. Did you have a question, Chidambar? No, you were reaching for the mic. Okay. Anyone else? Any reports from anything that you might have thought of during the week? Does anybody remember the class during the week? Thank you, Chidambar. What was the assignment? I promised I'd remember and I don't. What was the assignment? It had about devotion.
Devotion, yes.
Mm-hmm. Must have
when
been
I can remember
devotion.
It, uh-huh. I do everything for God, which keeps me present and heart involved and, you know, all of the things we're trying to do.
Right.
And it's surprising how quickly it comes and goes. And you forget for long periods of time.
Right.
But when you come back, you go, oh, right, this is what I'm doing. And a little bit this week, it was okay that I had failed for the last, you know, 99% of the time.
Very good. Very good. Frank Laubach called it the game of minutes. See if every minute you can remember God, even just for a fraction of a second. Go ahead.
So I've been trying to chant more this week. Uh-huh. And that helps me a whole lot to get into my heart space.
Uh-huh.
And again, it's not been every day, but there were a couple of times I was in the temple when there was nobody there, so it was a perfect opportunity to just do two or three chants. And
yeah,
it really, it's a good one for me.
Chanting is half the battle. That's one of the subjects we talk about tonight. Were you whispering about something?
You asked me if I did my homework.
50-50. 50-50. Okay. Any other comment? Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Saranya?
I just keep wondering, if you had to explain devotion to someone who knew of God but didn't understand what it meant, how would you explain it?
I find that the best way to talk about devotion, if you're really talking to somebody who doesn't know, is to start with the word devoted. And people understand the concept of being devoted to something. Many people are devoted to their families. They're devoted to their art. They're devoted to their jobs. They're devoted to something. And so people understand the idea that when you're devoted to something, it's much more than just an idea about it. You know, there's a kind of total involvement. That's what devoted means. Lance Armstrong, in his autobiography, when he was trying to refute the argument that he used performance-enhancing drugs, he described his daily workout and how, you know, what he did every day. And then he puts a little note in it. I do this every day. He said, every day. Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, my birthday, my children's birthday, New Year's Day. You know, basically, I don't need to take drugs because this is what I do. Okay, he's completely devoted to it. In other words, everything else in his life is defined and works around this one-pointed commitment, passion for one thing. And he doesn't hate it. He couldn't hate it because he's devoted to it. There has to be something in it for him. It comes back to him. So people choose what they're going to be devoted to. And we, as devotees of God, have chosen to be devoted to that consciousness. And, you know, you can talk about Satchitananda if you can, but what you're talking about is we're devoted to what happens to our consciousness when we tune in to a greater reality. That's what God is to us, is consciousness. And it's not a consciousness that's separate from us. It's what we ourselves have when we're focused on it. So the experience of that, being devoted to that, which may feel abstract to other people, but doesn't feel abstract to the devotee. I mean, you know, when you talk about love, it's a little hard to talk about. You love your children. You know, what is it that, what's happening? Something happens. I was talking about that last week. Something happens in relationship to those children. And you automatically are devoted to their welfare. And that's something many people can understand. And you're devoted to it because it's your duty, and there's lots of reasons, but because of the experience that you're having from it. And even though not everybody can understand this, there's an actual experience that comes into your consciousness when you're devoted to that higher reality. And so you naturally become devoted to it, and with being devoted comes the concept of devotion, which is that my heart is engaged, my feelings are engaged. This isn't just an idea to me. This is something that really makes itself, you know, the center of my reality. And I cultivate that sense of devotion because I find that it makes everything else better if I do that. Is that clear enough? Yeah, and you know, people think of devotion as emotion and this action and so on, but it's not. It's being devoted to. It's a really beautiful idea. And because, here's the other part of it, and devotion is our subject tonight, so this is exactly what we need to say. Reason follows feeling, and everything follows the preferences of the heart. It's really from the heart that our lives are run. And this phrase, reason follows feeling, is a very important principle of discrimination, which is whatever our feelings are predisposed toward, our mind will find lots of reasons. In the same way, like if your heart is sad, you will find lots of reasons to be sad. And as soon as your heart shifts into a happy feeling for whatever reason, you'll be in circumstances will be exactly the same, and your mind will find all these reasons why you can now be happy. But only when the mind, the heart is calmed of likes and dislikes, can the reason be trusted, so to speak. Adam has a question. Mr. X has a question.
It's not a question as much as when you were saying that.
Keep the microphone close enough so pick up on it.
I thought back to my school days when I was taking medication for ADHD, and I realized about a few years into it even that I was feeling a tremendous amount of stress when I was on it, and that I was finding reason throughout the day to be stressed, things to stress about. And I realized once I wrote them down and actually made the list of, you know, things to worry about, and then I looked at it later in a clearer state of mind, I thought, why the heck was I so stressed about all that? And so it's just funny that when you're talking about that, that it really makes a lot more sense to me in that context of, you know, almost justifying what the heart feels, because it's almost, this is the quicker one. This is the one that's first to the party, you know, and then the intellect sort of, you know, shows up later and makes sense of it all. So, I think in terms of, you know, other things that I just react to without, let's say, drugs.
And without noticing.
Sense. Exactly. Yeah,
you don't notice, and then if you have a bias, it also works the other way. I don't mean to use the same examples, but if you have a bias toward attractive women and you see an attractive woman, you may think how nice she is, and she's very, very spiritual. I mean, it's just like, give me a break. You know, reason follows feeling. And she may, in fact, be very, very spiritual, but you have to use your discrimination to be able to tell whether your feelings have predisposed you. And that's why, that's just the simple phrase, reason follows feeling. I mean, that's how very intelligent people can be very prejudiced against racial types or religious groups or something. They can be very intelligent. Look at the Nazis. Many of those people were highly educated, but they developed this, you know, belief that the Jews were the problem. And once the Jews were the problem, they found all these reasons why it was true. It's madness. But in little ways, it's always, if your heart is afraid, the mind will find all ways to follow it. So where were we? What was the actual question? There was a question in relation to this. Right, but there was...
How do you explain it to people?
Yeah. Oh, and something else. Oh, anyway, I lost it. I was going somewhere, but it's gone. So we went there, I guess, sufficiently. That'll be enough. I was saying reason follows feeling. Oh, well, so be it. It's also why the principle, and, you know, not the actual fact, but that's why the male is the head of the household and the female follows, you know. Oh, actually, that's backwards, isn't it? Reason follows feeling, isn't it? So like that. But also the female and the male energy, you know, represent reason and feeling, and they have to always be kept in balance. If one dominates the other, it doesn't work. You know, and that's why even though women, this is what I was really going to say, that's why even though the male is supposed to be the head of the household, the woman, by her, you know, active feeling, often ends up dominating the reason, even if reason tries to keep its position, because it's just a feeling has power. And there has to be this appropriate respect for both sides of it. And this is also a part of what is written in here. Devotion without discrimination can get you in a great deal of trouble. Because if you just let your feelings run away, feeling has to be kept in a state of reason, is how Master puts it. So feeling will influence reason in a wacky sort of way, but reason has to also assert itself. You have to become able to discern both. And so even though devotion is the first quality that's required of us, that doesn't mean we can turn our backs on things being reasonable. Just because you feel it does not really make it true. It means only that you feel it. And until, as I was saying earlier, the heart is purified, and the heart's likes and dislikes have been totally calmed. And don't think, I know what I was going to say, and don't think that that's easy to accomplish. I wrote in one of the stories about Swamiji, just this phrase that he said once. He said, people talk about when they meditate calming the mind. He said, but what you actually have to calm is the heart. Because if the heart is calm, the mind will be calm also. The mind becomes agitated when the heart is moving between likes and dislikes. And that's, again, why devotion becomes the key reality. Because when you're just in love with something and just loving it, you know, you have all that self-sacrificing clarity. And especially when your devotion is attuned to higher states of consciousness and you actually attune yourself to that vibration, those higher states of consciousness coming into you just bring the heart to a state of rest. Because what makes the heart agitated is the feeling of lack, the feeling of need, the feeling of inadequacy, the feeling of all those anger, despair, disappointment, all of those things which just constantly keep us sort of on the edge of ourselves. Isn't that so? And, you know, the wonderful thing about devotion is that when you have these devotional moments, you just come into a state of perfect rest. And that's what the effort of meditation is. But being able to come to that rest is greatly enhanced if the heart is engaged, because if the heart is engaged in an upward movement in devotion to God, then that means it has disengaged from all of its likes and dislikes. It's just been united in one direction. That's why, I mean, Master says chanting is half the battle. You know, when chanting really happens in a really dynamically beautiful way, it just, because music bypasses so many other aspects of our brain, it'll just take us right there, and especially the right kind of music, which the corollary of that is the wrong kind of music is extremely disturbing to the system, because we are sound waves, and when we allow ourselves to hear almost any of the music that's popularly played right now, it just pushes you in so many ego-activating directions that your whole system literally becomes like that. Whereas the other kind of music and, you know, genuinely inspired, high-minded, God-reminding music, of which, of course, what Swami's written and what Master's written is ideal. You just feel it in you. I mean, many of us who come to the kirtans, you know, most of the time I don't sing. I don't know, the chanting starts and I just get locked into the chanting and I play the bells sometimes. But you all feel it, you know, and you're just there. And then it doesn't occur to you to worry about your grocery list, your new car, whether or not you're going to get the dress, you know, just all that stuff. It just doesn't occur to you because you just have this one wave going through you. The more you do that, the more it becomes habitual. You know, one of the answers I was going to give to your question, which I forgot, was you can use your discrimination to think about what you need to push out of your life or what you need to renounce, but it's much better to use your willpower and your energy simply to add in what you want. Because if you add in what you desire to become, then you simply lose interest in the other things. And it's not like you have to make yourself not do this, which making yourself not do it is always a little challenging because sometimes you become even more obsessed with it because you're always pushing it away. So it depends on, you know, the level of what you're dealing with. If you're a drug addict, you may just have to push it away. You know, if you like Häagen-Dazs ice cream, maybe you should chant a lot and then eat your ice cream, you know, and just add in what you like and then see. But if you're 285 pounds on a 5'4" frame, maybe you should not eat the Häagen-Dazs. So it all depends on what you're dealing with. Okay? Yes, Victor.
Where is the center for discrimination located in our body?
I think you would say it would be the spiritual eye. I mean, that's how people usually talk about it. But this is divine discernment. And the spiritual eye is also, of course, I mean, the frontal lobe of the brain is where the reasoning faculty takes place. That's why men's foreheads are different than women's, because they have a different kind of brain. Because of the willpower. That's how Swami puts it. You know, the man's forehead, there's more energy there, and women have breasts. You know, because there's more energy here for a woman and there's more energy here for a man. So they can tell from a skull whether it was male or female because the male has different construction here and the women have different construction here. This is part of the way we're made. Of course, that's merely our starting point because the difference between male and female is created, it's physiological, but the soul has no gender. You start somewhere on the circle and then you expand out to embrace the whole of it. But it does come, reasoning power comes from the frontal lobe of the brain, so essentially from here, the power of the will. Feeling comes from the heart, yes? I see you, Saranya, you reacted enormously to that. Feeling, reason follows feeling. I think women are just as reasonable. What was it that meant? Oh, yes. Women are so personal in their responses, and the woman replies, well, I'm not. Go ahead.
You were just saying that just because you feel in your heart, how can you tell it's the right thing? You know, like, is there something that indicates, well, yes, it's, you feel it good, it's right, and it's feel good, but it's wrong?
By discrimination and by making really big mistakes. I mean, I have to be honest with you. You know, Swami Kriyananda tells the story of going forward and getting that land in India and then SRF not wanting it and just all the brouhaha that came from that. He told us that story for many, many years. And then after about 15 years, he mentioned that he didn't actually feel Master's guidance on getting that land. He didn't feel it in the way that he had felt it about many things, but his common sense told him it was the only thing to try to do. And he also thought it would be a good experiment to find out what would happen if he went forth with full willpower without having that same sense that he usually had. And he found out, you know, it was an experiment, and it taught him a lot. It didn't really work. He sort of felt like, in truth, that it wasn't really that he didn't feel Master's guidance. It's almost like he says in retrospect that Master knew what was going to happen. And he knew the pain that Swami was going to go through. And it was sort of almost like a precursor to hint what this was going to cause for him. Now, but what I like about that is just the courageous part of it. Well, you know, common sense said to do it. And he didn't quite have the same feeling that he usually had. But he would see what would happen. So really, as far as I know, the only way to really find out is you just have to experiment. You have to sort of sense, you know, that this, and you use your feeling and your reason together. This seems like a reasonable idea. I have a feeling that it's a good idea, so let me go toward it. And it's better not to throw yourself off a cliff, but just to sort of like start climbing down the cliff and sort of see step by step what kind of responses you get. But we all make really terrible mistakes, and we just make them, you know, and our lovely phrase is, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Or the phrase is, I really thought it was what I was supposed to do. And maybe it was. It just maybe wasn't supposed to work out. You know, we imagine that it's, if we're supposed to do it, it means it's supposed to work out in the way that we desire. There's a way that you begin to feel, that's the only thing I can say, and you look for signs of nervousness. That's what Swami often says, a kind of nervous energy. That is the sign that there's too much egoic involvement. But strangely, sometimes, even if there is a sense that it's the right thing, you can still be a little nervous just because, you know, there's energy around it, and maybe you're not certain, and you're going to have to risk a little bit. If there's excitement, and the sense of, oh, God, I have to do this, I'm going to do it right now. If there's no capacity to wait a minute, that's a bad sign. You know, any sense of urgency. You need to be a little cautious if you feel urgent. You can feel deep about something, but if it's really meant to be, you don't have to rush out and do it because it'll resolve itself. You can wait a minute. You can reflect a little bit. You can talk to a few people, and if it stays with you, it's one of the ways that you can tell. But it's, and sometimes, you know, it's just like there's no real rules. Sometimes inspiration comes more as an idea than a feeling, but there always has to be some feeling for it. And all I can say is over time you begin to be able to tell. I mean, I sort of have a way of saying it to myself. When it comes in that particular way, and I know what that particular way is, I trust it more than if it's just a good idea. You know, I'll often say, well, you know, this is a good idea. Or I'll say, you know, this felt like an inspiration when it came to me. So I'm not going to give it up just because you don't like it. It doesn't mean that I can't be persuaded away from it, but I'm more committed to it because it came as an inspiration and not just as a good idea. Some things are different. over time you find out. That's what discrimination is. You can tell by the fruits. You can tell by the feeling. You can tell by being honest enough to just simply and say, well, it seemed like a good idea at a time. What do I know? You know, Swami's always very humble about his guidance, has always been. He'll just say, seems like a good idea, doesn't it? He'll rarely say, Master told me to do this. You have to also, I think it's very important not to dogmatize your intuition. You know, you have a feeling that something's a good idea, and all of a sudden, Master told me to do this. And then you yourself have trapped yourself. Because now that Master has told you to do it, you really can't change your mind. And so you have to be a little careful. And also, if Master has told you to do it, nobody can tell you anything. Because who are they to stand against God? So even if you do feel that Master has told you to do it, just say it, leave space around that idea. Either don't articulate it too strongly or don't articulate it at all. Just sort of hold that thought and see where it goes. Because if it then becomes that, you're so committed to that, and then if it's wrong, then you just go to pieces. But it wasn't really the intuition, it was the dogmatizing it afterwards. Ramani has a question, has a thought here.
What do you think about asking Master to let you know that he, or asking him to help you?
Oh, that? Definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that can be said about how you work with guidance. I must admit I was giving a shorter answer. But if you're not sure, you can ask Master to help you know whether this is the right thing. You know, just to go forward and see what kind of responses you get. You know, how the world responds to you, how, whether circumstances open up, whether it really works. When I had that intuition about the pilgrim, I went forward and everything fell to pieces. But in that case, I withdrew and thought, if this was really the right idea, other people will see it. I'm not the only person in the world who can figure things out. And it was interesting to me that, in fact, everybody did come around. But I very nearly drove them into the wrong decision just by being so whatever I was about it. Dogmatic, like that. But you have to also, you know, asking Master to show you if it's the right thing, you have to be careful and not say, well, Master, if this is wrong, you're going to have to stop me. And once a young man said that to Swami, I'm going to do this, and if Master doesn't want me to do it, he'll have to stop me. And after he walked out of the room, Swami said to me, why would he? You know, it's just not a winning attitude. You know, this is what I'm going to do, and you can stop me. It's like a dare. But if you say sensitively, you know, I'm going to go forward, help me know if this is the right or the wrong thing. But these are hard lessons to learn, so you don't be too quick to say, oh, he did, he didn't, he has, he hasn't. You know, just, there's a lot of room to be wrong in this stuff, so you have to be real. Just do your best, don't be afraid to try it, but just be aware that this is a constant ongoing experiment. And then you'll watch, and then you'll be able to look back and say, oh, well, that really worked. And then what happens is you begin to recognize what it felt like when it works. You know, there's been a few times in my life when I just knew this was the right thing, and sometimes not everybody would agree, but I was just so comfortably certain with it, there was not even any point in asserting it. I just knew it would work. And so we just would go forward, and it always worked when I felt like that, because it was true. But I didn't learn that fast. It was learning that that caused Swami to say to me, whenever your ego gets involved, you make terrible mistakes, terrible decisions, you know, and I didn't know my ego was involved. I thought I was doing fine. And then I would just make terrible decisions. But I always have really held that, just wanting, like, I don't want to make a terrible decision here. I mean, isn't it insane? You'll just be so sure about something, and then a few days or a week or a month later, you'll think, good God, what could I have been thinking? And you'll just realize how much you were influenced by some prejudice that you just really didn't even know was there. But if you're honest, as things unfold, you say, whoa, was I ever caught up? Did you want to speak again, Ramani?
No, it's kind of like you said in the beginning, that when we're working with our consciousness, there's no boring moment, and it's fun.
Yeah.
And yours, and it is a lot of fun when you suddenly realize that Master
did
kind
like
of it. Answered you, yeah, and you just kind of go.
But he doesn't answer. You have to realize, you know, the approval of the guru does not come cheap. You just don't get it casually by just asking for it. You get it by rising to the vibration where he's vibrating. And so that's why you have to just be a little careful. I mean, yes, it's, and this is odd, you know, I'm going to talk to both sides of it. It's also good to always be in a constant conversation and always be thinking, you know, what do you want me to do, Master? We're going to go do this. We'll do this together. Just what Chidambar was saying. You do everything for God. Oh, we're going to go have a Haagen-Dazs ice cream. You know, don't we just love the Haagen-Dazs ice cream? You know, it's a pleasing sentiment, and it's not entirely untrue. And even if at first you're just kind of playing a game with your own mind, you're at least orienting your mind in the right direction. And by constantly orienting your mind in the right direction, you'll gradually make of that affirmation an actual experience. But we also, this is what I'm saying, you have to have a lot of respect for the fact that we can't just suddenly decide that we're going to be guided by God and then, oh, he'll say, oh yeah, sure, have anything you want. Just so you say, well, as far as I can tell, this seems like the right thing. You know, I've prayed on this, and this is what I feel now, so this is what I'm going to do. Don't make a dogma out of it. Fair enough. That's discernment and devotion all together, discrimination. Okay. Anything else? No. Okay. Well, then we will just go forward on this. Let's see. One of the facts that Swamiji wants us to understand about devotion, which is extremely important, is that a lot of people think about devotion in terms of having great experiences. Oh, I was so uplifted. Oh, I had such wonderful meditations. Oh, you know, visions and dreams and things came to me. And Swami wants us to really understand that devotion is an attitude and a commitment on our part. And it's not so much that God has decided to flood us with these experiences. And the reason we have to understand that is severalfold. One is, we don't want to be vaishyas in our spiritual life. Vaishyas, I know some of you don't understand that as clearly, but the vaishya is the merchant level of consciousness. And it's not just about people who are storekeepers. But the merchant level of consciousness is, I'm perfectly willing to give if I get back an equal value. And it's better than just wanting to take and give nothing, which is the level of consciousness below it. But above the merchant level is what's called the kshatriya level, where you just do it because it's the right thing to do. And you're not thinking all the time about what the reward is going to be. So if we're really going to be devotees, we have to learn not to be vaishya in our devotion. And to think that really what this is about is that if I have the right attitude, God gives me all these experiences. It's just great as long as those experiences go on. But the kind of experiences, devotional upliftment that we have, is a gift. And we can't command a gift. It's not something we purchase. You know, a gift will come to us and we don't know. There's this aspect of the spiritual path, which is annoying in a certain sense, but it's just absolutely true, which is we have to really prove our faithfulness to the divine search and to the divine self before we can really be constantly unified with that. In a way, I mean, you can put it in all sorts of image ways, but if you have been unfaithful to someone for a long time, and then it suddenly occurs to you that maybe you really want to love them, whoever that is going to be just a little bit cautious and is going to wait a while to see whether or not you really are sincere about this. And that's just the way nature would work, because it would be throwing pearls before swine. Just say, oh, well, you said you've changed. Here's everything. You know, it would be of no value if it were given away just because you had a whimsical thought. So in our relationship to God, we have to realize that we've been unfaithful for incarnations. And we have sought after every possible other reality than this inward truth. And now, just because we've decided this is what we want to do, we have to really win God's love for us, in a certain sense, or how would I say that more accurately? We have to train our own consciousness to really be strong and loyal. And it's wonderful if, when we meditate and we open our hearts, all these things happen. But even if they don't, we have to still be enough of a devotee that we're willing just to stick with it, because we have become Kshatriya devotees. This is simply what we do. We have understood that this is the path to fulfillment. This is who I really am. This is what the divine is calling me to do. And therefore, this is what I do. And what comes back to me is less important than my absolute faith that this is what my duty is. That's what a Kshatriya follows. You know, people give birth to children. Some of those children, they automatically love more than they love other of their children. Some of their children are more simpatico with their own nature than other of their children are. And some babies are sick all the time, or fussy. My mother-in-law said to me, and I think she was kidding, that David was such a difficult baby that if he had been the first, he would have been the last, is how she put it. And she did wait a while before she had the third child. You know, but of course, even though he was a fussy and a difficult baby, she took care of him. It wasn't about, he's not being nice to me, you know, he's not letting me sleep. It was just, this is what I have to do. So we have to have that attitude in our devotion, because we go through ups and downs. And our commitment has to, even our heart's love feeling has to be also guided by reason and held on principle. And it's not just, oh, well, that didn't really work for me today, so I'm going to go try something else. There has to be this, you know, underlying faith in what we're doing and understanding of what we're doing. All right? Let's take a little bit of a break, then we'll come back to this. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a question. And Tom had one too. Tonight's been a nice little discussion. Everybody seemed to have made up for weeks of silence. Go ahead, Edwin. Edwin, hold it just a little closer. This is all for the people who listen on the internet, which is a lot of people.
Uh-huh. You were talking about chanting. You know, I don't play the harmonium or anything, so can you actually just kind of mentally chant, like, you know, without work, the same thing?
Absolutely. Inward chanting, you can just recite it, or recite it with a little bit of melody if you want. No, it doesn't have to be outward at all. In fact, he says that in your chant outwardly, but chant inwardly all the time. Just, you know, repeat the phrases and sing it any way you feel like singing it. Yeah. And, you know, it adds energy to it if you can do more, but if you can't and it's not in you to do it, just the quiet chanting is wonderful. It captures your attention, and then it washes you out. That's the only word I can sort of think about.
It gets
the heart energy moving, and it washes out the impurities. It's like sluicing for a gold, you know. You're running the water through, and everything else is getting washed out, and only the little gold nuggets are left. It just runs through you, because we are sound. We are a manifestation of the Om. So that's why music is so powerful, because it's what we're made of. We are vibrating as sound because we're the Om. And the more sound you run through you that's closer to the Om, the more you align. That's why the noise pollution that we live with and the quality of the music is so detrimental to consciousness. And I think it was either a documentary or a fiction movie. I don't know which it was, but I think it was valid. It was a picture of some barbaric behavior on the part of modern people. You know, some ravaging hordes and probably in some country in the midst of civil war. And it was a lot of young adolescent and just past adolescent men who were rampaging against others, and they had boom boxes with really harsh music playing all the time. You know, and when people go off to war, they go off marching like this, and it keeps them moving, and it goes in the direction that they're trying to go. And, you know, some martial music is uplifting. This was just violent and hateful and insane, just like their behavior. But naturally, they liked it because they were violent and insane, and so that's what they wanted. But we're hearing music all the time that's violent and insane. And you'd have to, I mentioned, was it last week I talked about being in the Burbank airport? Was it here that I talked about it? I was in the Burbank airport coming back from Los Angeles late at night. It was a while ago. I took a late plane. And I was pretty tired by the time I got to the airport because I'd been doing a lot in L.A. And I was, so I finally got to the airport and I was sitting there. Plane was delayed. And I was sitting there, just sitting there, feeling worse and worse and worse, just out of sorts, becoming agitated, really wondering why I was traveling to Los Angeles all the time, what was going on. And then I finally realized, but because I was tired, I didn't catch it at first, this horrible music was playing. And it was literally, it was like shifting me. And it was partly the reason it was shifting me so much is because I hadn't noticed it was playing. And when I noticed it was playing, I essentially created my own counter force to it. And even though I couldn't get away from it, and I didn't have any way of stopping, I didn't have the brains to realize I did have a way to stop my ears, but I didn't think about it. I just created a counter magnetism and started creating my own vibration, and I sort of pushed it away. But not having thought about it, the same thing happened to me once. I was in Whole Foods, and I was trying to buy laundry soap. I mean, that's a fairly simple task, isn't it? And the laundry soap was way down on the bottom shelves, and so I'm down here like this, and I just couldn't figure out what laundry soap to buy. And I was just struggling and struggling, and I began to think, buying laundry soap is not difficult. Why am I having so much trouble? And then I realized that there was a speaker over my head, and it was playing some horrible music. Horrible to me means raucous and egoic and heavy and harsh, and it was just beating on me. And I was like, I got lower and lower on the floor, and I just couldn't think. And again, it was like I hadn't noticed that it was there, and so it was just, it was moving me. And when I noticed it was there, I pushed it back, and I bought the stupid laundry soap. Then I walked up to the manager of the store. I said, look, this is a very expensive store, and a whole lot of people who come in here are a lot older than you. They're people like me. And this is horrible. You know, it's just like, you can't think in this atmosphere. You're just totally rattled. Swami actually wrote a little brochure that he wanted us to carry around to stores. And it said, you know, you need to put the right kind of music into your store so that people can think when they shop. Because, and I very often, this is a one-man campaign. This is karmic retribution. My uncle, the one I still visit in Philadelphia, who's elderly now, he hated this kind of music, and he was a curmudgeon even as a younger man, and he's a very old curmudgeon now, and he used to always make scenes about the music in restaurants and so on like that, and it would embarrass me so much as a child. So now I find myself behaving exactly the same way. But I make it a point whenever I'm in any store where the music is horrible to tell them, sometimes I'll tell them, I am walking out without buying anything. Because I can't stand the sound of this room. And you like it, you're 17 years old, but I'm your customer. But that was all about why the opposite is also true and why you have to be very, very careful about how profoundly you can affect yourself. That's why Swamiji's mantra CDs, the Om Mantra CD and the Mahamitranjaya, and the Gayatri Mantra, where he just repeats those sounds over and over again. You know, if you're ever having trouble meditating or if you're agitated in your heart for any reason, I mean, much of Swami's music will help you, but just those mantras, you know, you just lock into those mantras and you just allow your system to align with those mantras and it'll change you. Just literally, it'll change you. Swami got a letter once from someone who, I can't remember what his situation was, but it's very, very difficult. And he just didn't know what to do with himself. So he started playing Swami's mantra, the mantras over and over and over, and everything in his life shifted. And he felt it was just exactly because his whole vibration shifted into those mantras. And once it shifted into there, everything else began to happen differently. It cannot be overemphasized. And the other side, which is interesting, and, you know, well, I was going to say, don't get me started, but I've got myself started on this subject. Indicative of the consciousness of this planet. Swamiji has commented on several occasions that he feels that war is inevitable He says, just listen to the music. He said the music is like ready to explode, and it's driving people toward explosion. You know, and I mean some of the lyrics are, well, many of the lyrics are just explicitly horrible, but you don't even have to hear the lyrics. You just hear this fight energy. Where is that going to go when people just get like that? You know, they're going to do something with it, and it's not going to be pretty. And it's one of those things, too, that the more it goes, the more it has to keep going. Someone said the problem with speed is however fast you go, you get used to it, and you need to go faster. Yeah. So you asked the question at the break.
Yes, you can just rephrase it.
And the question that Tom asked was, you know, looking around the planet, as I've just been taking us on a small tour of the planet, it doesn't look real pretty right now, you know, in every place. There's just so much. And how are we as devotees supposed to relate to it? I think the answer is really very simple, is that we have to have a counterweight of divine consciousness. And on the other side, I mean, who cares? You know, it's like, what's going to happen is going to happen. Swami, at the satsang on Sunday, and you all probably saw it here, I was in the room as it happened in Los Angeles, and this woman said something like, you know, why should we put out any energy at all if everything is already determined? And he answered by saying, oh yeah, it is all determined. I mean, he talked about the book of Bhrigu, I think, and the Agastya readings. He talked about these ancient readings that just thousands of years ago pinpointed exactly who you are, you know, what your name is going to be, who your guru is going to be, what your parents are going to be like from thousands of years ago. And so it's a strange, the whole question, and the real question is free will. You know, how much free will do we have in this situation? And on one hand, we don't have any because we have already gotten in the car, we've already gotten in a certain lane, and we've already pushed the accelerator down. And so there's so much momentum in what we're doing that the mere fact that some little idea crosses our mind doesn't mean that we're going to be able to shift everything. Now, on one hand, that's very disturbing. On the other hand, that's also extremely relaxing. You know, because here it is. I'm on the train. I bought my ticket. I even have my assigned seat. And, the scenery is going to whiz by. But there's so much about it that's already there. Why am I so anxious about so much? I mean, it's part of the karma that you set in motion that you are so anxious about so much. But Swamiji said the only free will we really have, he didn't say this yesterday, but he said it in other settings, the only free will we really have is attuning our consciousness to the divine behind it or not. And when we attune ourselves to the divine consciousness behind whatever else is happening, it doesn't matter what happens. And so the reason we need to act and to act in a deliberate way with a great deal of will is because we suffer otherwise. And we think that we suffer because of the things that are happening. And so we imagine, if I do this, then that won't happen. But that's just, again, I want this, I don't like that. But the real freedom we have is to just step out of that duality and step into the center. And so we have apparently chosen, and it's not bad yet. I mean, not really bad yet. We're all just living our lives. I mean, none of us have really been interrupted. I remember after September 11, the local ministers association sponsored an event in front of City Hall in Palo Alto. And one of the people they got up to speak was a man from Lebanon or one of those countries. It might have been Lebanon. He was a Stanford student. And he stood up, and, you know, they asked him because he was a Muslim, and, you know, this is Palo Alto, so we were, you know, like doing like that. And so he stood up as a Muslim, just a young man, and he said something like, you know, the first time my town was bombed, I was 3 years old, and by the time I was 10, I'd been in 15 bombing raids. And, you know, I mean, he just was stating how he'd grown up. And here he'd made his way to Stanford and was living, I mean, and it was just like everyone else, we just looked at each other like, that has just not been our experience. And he's lived in a fractured world his whole life. His world has always been fractured, and our world has not. We've had personal events, but our world has not been fractured. I'm old enough to have been through the Vietnam War, but not personally. Just I was there when it happened. But we haven't yet been interrupted. But if we're going to be interrupted, I mean, we're going to be interrupted because this is like the force is there. And it's all just a matter of becoming inwardly conscious. So we can wait until it becomes really difficult, or we can become inwardly conscious now. The more inwardly conscious we are, the more wherever we are, we'll just move through it. I mean, I'm in the Whole Foods. I'm not thinking about my inward consciousness, and I can't even buy laundry soap. But as soon as I concentrate on the realities that I know to be true, you know, even when it's screaming at me, much of the time, it doesn't affect. Now, where's the limit of that? There is no limit of that. And if we want an incentive, you know, for serious sadhana, I think looking around and seeing where the world is going is a really good incentive for serious sadhana, but it's always true. When I was talking to Swamiji once about this planet and how unattractive it was to me at that moment, I said something like, just jokingly, if we ever incarnate again, sir, let's wait until Satya Yuga. And he didn't even want that to stand. He said, I don't intend to incarnate again, very strongly. Although at other times he's mitigated that by saying, well, I suppose if it would be helpful to others. He sort of sighs like that. And then he sort of says, I know my own nature well enough. I said, well, that's the only reason you came this time, isn't it? And he said, was silent for a moment, he said, well, yes, like that. But anyway, but he said, even in Satya Yuga, he said, it's still just the material plane. You know, it's more pleasant, as he said, because people like us are in charge, and the whole world is like Ananda. But it's still just the material plane. It still doesn't ever give you what God gives you. So if it's, you know, magnificently horrible or passably pleasant, we're never going to be content until we make this effort.
Sorry. If our lives are sort of running on these tracks that are predetermined, and if the circumstances of our existence can be predicted from thousands of years prior, do we gain liberation faster by seeking attunement constantly? In other words, if the train we are in is our consciousness and the destination is self-realization, do we get there faster by seeking the divinity behind the inevitabilities of our existence?
Well, see, I'm going to answer this question a little bit the way I know Swami would answer it, which is not really the way I would answer. There's no faster or slower in the realm of divine consciousness. Our thought that it's faster or slower is just something that we think of living here. We think that there's tomorrow and there's today and that I'm going to wait so long and then this is going to happen. But as soon as we step into the inner reality, there is no faster or slower. So we can suffer or not suffer. That's basically what it comes down to. Because the question is then, if it's all predetermined, why would we do it? Because we suffer. And we desire to be in a state of bliss, and we desire to escape suffering. And at certain points, that dynamic begins to work on us, and it begins to occur to us that I need to change my consciousness, and that's the key to my stopping, to my having more bliss and less suffering. And apparently, and I mean, I don't know what any of this means either, apparently, you know, that is a dynamic that is predictable, because the forces will play together, but at a certain point we will begin to shift our consciousness. And so the moment when we do that, so I mean, I suppose one can say, oh, well, then I guess I'll just sit here until that moment comes, but that means that you're just going to sit there, but that was predictable. It's almost better not to even think about it.
That's kind of what I'm...
Yeah. I mean, what it comes down to is, I get up this morning, what can I do to make this day a better day? Because I'm the only one experiencing it.
Part of my discernment is to learn to not ask questions that don't get me anywhere.
Yes.
Because intuitively, I know it's better for me to seek attunement.
Yes.
And to seek holy places and good, you know, company and things like this. And because my mind can't comprehend the purpose of all that, once, you know, in the face of the problem of free will, it's like, you know, why go there?
Well, see, that what you're actually saying, Victor, is profoundly wise, because this is the difference between intellectual interest and feeling interest. Feeling interest is, I need this. I don't really need to get all these other questions answered. When I asked Swami the question that had come up in another class, there was another class in which someone asked, if Master remembered all the way back to being a diamond, let's see, how long are you a diamond before you stop being a diamond? How did he get out? Like, what do you happen after you're a diamond? Do you go, like, do you become an emerald? Like, where do you go? And so Swami's answer to this was, compared to eternity, time doesn't make any difference. It's just like, you know, we think it's a long time being a diamond, but it's nothing compared to eternity. Then he said afterwards, what a useless question. I said, well, on a practical level, yes, but I thought it was fascinating. I mean, he was just joking, but it was like, because it's just an intellectual interest then. The question wasn't asked in the context. It was not just an intellectual interest, and I thought it was so intriguing I had the chance to ask, but it's just intellectual. Like, what difference would it make to your life how long it takes to get out of a diamond? And you can sort of act like that's really, like, so important that I have to know this, or it's so important that I have to know, you know, exactly all these different details. But if you just play out all of that, you never actually do anything. And people who are feeling motivated by the longing of the heart, well, devotion. It's the longing of the heart for another reality. And if the heart does not really long for another reality, you'll just ask questions forever. And, you know, there's a kind of energy of people who ask questions forever. And after a while, you know, you just can't keep answering them, because that's all they really want to do. And yes, it's a stage, and they'll progress from that. But, you know, a person such as myself, to me it's like, I mean, I remember Shivani's one of Ananda's legends. She's been living in Italy for 25 years now, so people in America don't know her so well. But she's a small, short person. She's not short. She's distilled. She's just distilled into pure willpower. She's a very powerful lady, and she was in a seclusion. This was many years ago, and she just became obsessed with this question of why did God create the world, and after she came out of seclusion, she had a chance to ask Swami, and in sort of the way she describes it, she asked him, because she's a little short, you know. And she just basically said to Swamiji, why? And he said, Shivani, what difference would it make? You know, it's like, even if you knew, what difference would it make? The problem for you is just the same. You're either suffering or you're not. And if you're suffering, in other words, if you're hungry, you're going to go eat something. If you're just interested in menus, you just keep reading the menus, but you never order anything because you're not hungry. You collect them. And once you're hungry, you don't really care about those things. You just need to do something. And so that whole question of predetermined free will, it just doesn't matter, because I know in this moment that I need a certain reality. And that's when the heart gets engaged. And that's, again, why you cultivate that longing of the heart, and you cultivate that feeling of the heart, because that's when you move. And you all know people who are intellectually interested. My 1 year at Stanford, I was looking for wisdom, and I took a class on consciousness. I thought, well, that'll be great, because I had already had a clue that consciousness was sort of what I was looking for. And I thought I don't know what I thought we were going to do, but what they did not attract me. We sat around and we talked about consciousness, and we just, like, speculated and raised different issues and contradicted each other and argued about different theories. And I wanted to do something about consciousness. And there just wasn't the game. You know, the game that was being played was, we were just going to talk about it. We weren't hungry. Nobody else in the room was hungry. I was starving. And they apparently were completely, like, without interest. They just were going to chat. And that didn't work for me. So I went and partied, is what I did for my first year at Stanford. And then I flunked out, and then I went home. It worked. Worked for me. Spent a lot of my parents' money for no real reason, but I was really, really hungry, and they weren't. So I went out for experiences. I mean, when I say I partied, I just went out to have experiences because I wanted something to happen. That wasn't what I wanted to have happen either, but at least it was more interesting than what else I was doing. But since some people in this room are trying to finish college, maybe I should be quiet. When people come to talk to me... It's a bad thing because, you know, sometimes people will come to me about college and I have to say, listen, I'm not the one to ask. It's not really my thing. Depends. I say, ask them, do you really want to finish or do you want to quit? If you really want to quit, you can talk to me. Okay. I know, but
That's a little part of my question about what am I supposed to do?
Right.
In relation to the world being a devotee and the world not being a devotee. So, and yet, you know, we all have to go to the store and you have to, there's lots right. and lots and lots of people that you have to relate to who are not interested in what we're doing.
Right.
But they, at least I think they need what we're doing.
Oh, but you know, you have to help people you have to help people to their own next step. You can't help somebody who's standing here to take a step that's a whole football field. Their legs won't stretch that far. So you love them. Self-evident. You love them. Yeah. Everybody wants love. Everybody wants to be looked at and recognized. Everybody wants to feel that they matter in the world. And you can do that. And you do that, you just go through this world like an angel. Everybody, that's what angels do. Angels just walk around loving. That's what we do. We just look at each other look at anyone. And think about the bliss of their soul and just project even the smallest amount of that. People are like desiccated sponges. You know, just you're checking out your groceries and you stop and you actually, you know, instead of them trying to read your name off your, you know, the tag and try to say good morning to you because they're instructed to. I mean, you just really, good morning. And you just chat with them. Nice day today. We're having a little rain. Whoa, look at those tomatoes. Aren't those beautiful? I mean, just create a reality. And I worked retail stores when I was, you know, before I was 20. That was like the kind of work I did. And just one person coming into the store and actually having a human contact with me makes your whole day. You know, just somebody who's just recognizes that you're a living being with the consciousness. And they just, I mean, this, it was amazed to me how much difference it would make if just one person came into the store and just had a straight-up relationship with me like I was a real person. And I've always remembered that, so whenever I go into a store, I always think how really boring this work can be and how much difference it makes if somebody acknowledges you. Just to never underestimate. This is what Dr. Ritchie, who had his out-of-body experience, the book, they've changed the name of it. It used to be called Return from Tomorrow. It has a slightly different name now. It's a great story of death and return. But one thing he realized, just really solidly, that every single encounter with every human was important because every one of them was an opportunity to love, and he had been really, really lousy at it, and he was really embarrassed. And when he came back from that, he stopped being casual. He stopped being indifferent. Because God was always asking him to love. That was when he died and Jesus said, how much have you loved? He said, I'm just a young man. I haven't had really any chance to do anything. He said, how much have you loved? Well, you know, it was really hard for me and I wasn't. And Jesus said, how much have you loved? And then he had to say, not much. But when he came back, he made up for it. So I think that's a simple answer. And that's why, who cares what happens? We just keep doing that, and then we're not even in what's happening. We're just in that flow of love. Okay? Enough? Okay, good night.